I'm now joined by Sal Bruno, Chief Investment Officer at Index IQ, which is part of New York Life Investments. They currently offer 20 ETFs, about $3.3 billion invested, including several alternative ETFs, led by their flagship IQ Hedge Multi-Strategy Tracker ETF, ticker symbol QAI. Sal is on the line with me from New York. Sal, always great having you on the show.
Nate, it's great to speak with you.
Okay, so I want to start with the financial markets because you've been involved in portfolio management for some 25 years now. You've obviously seen a lot of ups and downs. And if we go back to earlier this year, the S&P 500 dropped nearly 35%. We saw credit markets freeze up. I feel like it was truly a panic-type environment. And then you fast forward to today, here we are, stocks at record highs. There's apparently plenty of liquidity in the credit markets. And all of this happened in the span of 5-6 months. I'm curious, what was your take on everything back in March? And then how are you feeling about things right now?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, you talk about what a change of events we've seen over the past, 5 to 6 months. You know, back in March, it really was fear, I'd say bordering on panic. And you just saw credit market seize. You saw strategies that normally work fairly well when the markets go down. But, you know, you had this general fear that was in a panic situation going on. And nobody really knew what was going on with this virus, what it would take for it to try and get the virus under control, and what the implications would be of a shutdown on the economy and the markets. And so that fear really kept going until around the third week of March when the Fed stepped in and really provided a lot of liquidity and provided liquidity, and they said they would start buying bonds and bond ETFs. Eventually they got around to that. And so that really put a floor under the fixed income markets and helped to ease some of the credit tensions we had seen there and the liquidity issues. And the same was true on the equity markets. You also factor in the fact that we had, you know, a tremendous amount of government stimulus, expanded unemployment benefits that went further in terms of the amount of money, that went further in terms of the time period that people would be covered. And so you started to put a lot of money back into the economy, not just the capital markets, but back into the economy. And I think that really did a great job of providing confidence to at least the capital markets that things would actually be okay. And remember, capital markets tend to be forward-looking discounting mechanisms. And so they were trying to look past the shutdown to see what the economy would look like post-shutdown, trying to anticipate would there be a V-shaped recovery or K or whatever, and there's so many different letters out there. And ultimately we saw kind of a V-shaped recovery in certain segments of the market. So manufacturing has done really well. We just had a report come out this morning that continues strong manufacturing numbers, strong real estate numbers. Very good labor, after taking an initial hit, we started to see recover. It hasn't fully recovered, but we've started to see the initial claims come down pretty sharply. The consumer is still kind of on a weak basis, and I think a lot of municipalities are going to have some issues going forward. So right now, we've had some very strong capital markets, some recovery in the economy, but I think people are nervous. We have upcoming elections. We have the end of the government stimulus and nothing really in its place. We also have back to school, and we've seen the effect on college campuses of is this the second wave of the coronavirus coming. So, you know, we've seen some really strong performance, but right now I think people are getting a little nervous again.
Sal, when you talk about a potential recovery in the economy, and you mentioned the manufacturing numbers, I do think a lot of the discussion right now centers on, I'll say, reconciling the stock market with the economic data. And I keep saying the same thing. We all know the stock market isn't the economy, right? I get all that. Yep. But I also don't think you can just ignore what's happening when you look at things like unemployment. And I do think there's some real devastation across small businesses in particular. I think we're seeing some cracks in certainly commercial real estate, residential real estate's on fire. But
yeah.
Does this matter? Like, does the economy and stocks need to reconcile at some point? Or do you feel like the Fed and government stimulus just completely distorts everything here? Just how do you view those two, sort of divergent areas?
Yeah, so I think, government stimulus and Fed money, I think, has papered over or helped to cover up some of the underlying weaknesses that you've described very accurately. And when you look at the stock market, it's really interesting. You have to look kind of at what's leading the market, and it's really been led by what I call consumer tech. Now, that's not technically a sector. According to the GICS definition, there's consumer, there's technology, but I think there actually should be a sector called consumer tech, things like Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple. Amazon by itself has been more than 100% of the contribution of total return of the S&P 500 since it hit its previous high on February 19th. So from February 19th to the end of the month, which you just said yesterday, more than 100% of the return of the market has actually come from one name. That would be Amazon. So when you say the market is doing well, that's great, but it's really three or four names that are driving it. The average stock in the S&P is actually down about 6% over that time period, despite the fact that the S&P is up a couple of percent. More than half the names are actually still in negative territory. So, you know, when we look at what is the market, you know, it can be a little bit distorted by concentration in these consumer tech names.
Does that give you any concern when you look at the FANG stocks and we look at something like Tesla that's up, what, 490-500% year to date? You look at Zoom spiking this morning. When you see those types of names moving the way they are and just adding billions in market cap, does that cause you any concern?
It doesn't, to the extent that much of the rest of these stocks are being left behind. If we were to see a whole bunch of stocks kind of going up, we had greater breadth, that would give us a little bit more confidence. But when you have kind of these one-offs, that's great if you own them, but it's you know, really kind of like trying to shoot an arrow and hitting a particular stock. And, you know, we know individual stocks can be very risky. When you get a diversified basket, that tends to be a much safer, more consistent type of return pattern. But we're not seeing that right now. So, yes, that does give us cause for concern on a going-forward basis, especially when you look at the overall, you know, future expected return. So for the equity market, it's trading at a forward PE of 27, which is very high historically, with only a 1.6% yield. It's priced, basically every metric is elevated, whether it be price to book, price to sales, price to cash flow. And so the forward-looking expected returns for equities, so any individual stock could be terrific potentially. You know, there's nothing to say Tesla can't go up even more from here. But I think overall as a market, we have to be a little bit concerned about the valuation that's in place and what that means for forward returns on the equity market. Fixed income market, you know, equally so. On the treasuries, you have the 10-year treasury yielding 72 basis points. And so with the Fed committed to keeping rates at zero, but not trying to let them go below zero, there's really very limited scale for fixed income returns on a going forward basis at, you know, 72 basis points of yield on the 10-year, and probably not a whole lot of price appreciation. The yields can't go down that much more from here. So I think on a forward-looking basis, we have to question the expected returns for both equities and fixed income.
Okay, so with that in mind, because I think you raised some good points, especially on the fixed income side, from a portfolio management perspective, and let's just assume a traditional 60-40 investor. I think that's always a good frame of reference for most people. What do you think are some key factors those types of investors should be considering right now, given what we're seeing in both stocks and bonds?
Well, I think it's really key to manage your risk and to look for additional sources of returns, uncorrelated sources of returns. So, for example, in fixed income, people still need yield, and they're getting very little from their basically their treasuries or their bank accounts, and so they've been bidding up high-yield bonds. And so if you look at spreads on those have come in dramatically, despite the fact that if you look at defaults, those are actually rising pretty rapidly. And so what we would recommend is for people who want to just continue to get income but are a little bit concerned about the risk they're taking to do it, is potentially segment the high-yield marketplace and own the least risky bond. So we have an ETF, HYLV, High Yield Low Volatility. It takes the 50% least risky bonds each month, and that least risk is defined by things like spread and duration, typical things that people look at for risk for bonds, and tries to own those. Now, you're not getting quite as much yield as the overall market, the overall high-yield market, but you're still getting a very competitive yield, but potentially cutting some of that downside risk should some more of those defaults start to magnify. And so we think that, you know, a smarter way to try to get core exposure is one way to try to navigate these particular times. Also, alternative strategies can be really helpful in this time period. And we have a whole suite of liquid alternatives. Many of them are based on the concept of hedge fund replication. So what we're trying to do is to look at different and well-known hedge fund strategies, things like long, short, event-driven, market-neutral strategies, and not actually owning individual hedge funds or even their individual positions, but just trying to identify what are the key factors that are driving those returns. For long, short, it's definitely been growth versus value, you know, large cap versus small cap, things like that. And we invest in other ETFs to get those exposures. But those have actually proven themselves to really dampen over this time period that we've seen, really help dampen some of the downside volatility that you've experienced in the equity markets, And then help participate in the upside. And one of the really interesting things is you talked about the S&P, you know, the market's being down 30, 35%. And what a lot of people don't realize is when something's down 35%, you need much more than 35% to recover. To get back to where you were, you actually need 50%. Now, we just kind of crossed over that threshold at the end of August, so now the S&P is back in slightly positive territory since the drawdown began. But if you look at strategies like our long short, QLS, or QED, which is our event-driven, because they went down so much less than the S&P during that time period, but they participated in the upside, they're actually pretty much right about where the S&P is, you know, peak to peak, but with significantly less volatility. So we think that those are really interesting strategies for potentially diversifying some of that downside risk in the portfolio while still maintaining some upside exposure.
And Sal, I think that makes a lot of sense when you talk about mitigating that downside risk. I think with alts, really the idea is to add diversification to a portfolio. They can have a lower correlation to the equity market. One question I would have is, let's say we get a scenario where stock returns are muted moving forward. We talked about where valuations are right now in some of these high-flying tech stocks. But let's say moving forward, things aren't quite as rosy. And then we already know where fixed income is at with how low yields are. And so our expectations for returns there moving forward, I think, have to be muted. How do alts typically react? And I'm using the term alts broadly, but how do alts typically react in that type of environment?
So there's a range of alts, and you acknowledge, you know, we're talking about a wide range of strategies. There, on one end, there are, you know, things that are really trying to be very, very defensive, things we call like sort of tail risk, hedging type strategies, all the way up to commodities, which one could consider alts as well, which tend to have a lot more upside in sort of late cycle type of an environment. You know, when we're looking at our strategies, they tend to be more in the 5 to 10% volatility range, so more like core hedge fund type strategies, things like long, short, event driven, QAI you mentioned, which is our largest and oldest ETF, which covers a whole, it covers six different hedge fund strategies. You know, those tend to dampen some of the volatility on the downside, but also try to participate on the upside. You know, one strategy which we haven't discussed yet is our merger arbitrage ETF, ticker is M&A, pretty easy to remember for mergers and acquisitions. And that particular strategy tends to have very low correlation to the S&P 500. Now, one of the things we saw in that particular strategy is during the fear that gripped the not only the economy but the markets in March, merger arbitrage strategies broadly across the board kind of sold off, because one of the great things about merger arbitrage strategies is that their risk tends to be very uncorrelated or very deal-specific. So each individual deal really has nothing to do with what's going on with the overall economy or the market. It tends to be, will this deal get completed or will it get rejected? And what happened, though, in March is the risk of deals getting highly correlated with each other. In other words, everybody was worried, because we were entering into these uncharted waters, that all deals would basically fall off. We didn't know which ones were going to complete or not. And so we started to see the deal premiums start to widen out, and that led to merger arbitrage strategies getting hit a little bit harder than, you know, many people had anticipated. Once we started to get sort of a thawing of that risk, we started to see the strategies come back sharply and pretty much recovered most of what they had lost over that time period. So in normal market sell-offs, the type of environment you're talking about, that's really not fear or panic related, but just more equity markets are elevated, we're worried about valuation, those types of sell-offs, a merger arbitrage strategy can actually do really well. We saw in the fourth quarter of 2018, when the equity markets were down, you know, was about 20%, 21%, merger arb strategies were basically flat to slightly positive for that fourth quarter of 2018. So in that type of environment, we think merger arb strategies can actually do really well.
Sal, just a couple minutes left. I know you and I have visited about this in the past, but I do feel like with alternatives, for a lot of investors, it just feels like a complicated space. It's not as straightforward as stocks and bonds, at least on the surface. Can you offer any tips for investors? Like, how can they get more comfortable here? Because when you talk about merger arbitrage and hedge fund replication, I know for some investors that comes across as complicated. Any tips on improving the level of comfortability here?
Well, I'd say first and foremost, visit our website, iqetfs.com, iqetfs.com. And that we have a whole host of resources on education. We are trying to be as transparent as possible, not only on our strategies, but also what liquid alts mean in general. And so, you know, we're very happy to have conversations myself or anybody on our team is very happy to have that conversation with anybody who wants to go a little bit deeper, wants to understand, you know, how the strategy works, but probably even more importantly, what it can do for your portfolio, how it is that we try to manage some of the downside volatility while still maintaining some of the upside exposure. We're happy to have those conversations. So definitely visit our website, reach out to us, and we can definitely set up those conversations.
Well, Sal, excellent perspective. Always appreciate the time. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thanks, Nate.
That was Sal Bruno, Chief Investment Officer at Index IQ.